much, Ian. Appreciate you inviting me, and thanks for everybody for coming. Not that you could go anywhere else. They chose this hotel so that you'd be completely locked in for the next 2 days. I tried to walk out of here to see if there was somewhere nice to go and sit and have a cup of coffee this afternoon. Nothing. Motorway, service stations, not a thing. So bad luck, you're here. Is this the future? Maybe it is the future, because something very weird is going on in our world. You only have to look at the program to see that something very unusual is happening. Just look at some of the sessions. We're now talking about getting content from China. 5 years ago, any meeting I went to on editing or publishing, we weren't talking very much about China. We're talking about selling to the BRICS countries. Really weren't talking about that very much 5 years ago either. Talking now about supplanting peer review. Well, we'll talk a little bit about that in the next few minutes. And then a great title, they're out to get us. So this sense of sort of clinging on to the side of a rock face by your fingernails while somebody's stamping on your toes. This feeling of desperation that you just might not be here in a few years' time. What's all this about? The polite language that's being used in the program is we're going through a phase of transition or change. But isn't it something possibly a little bit more than that? What I want to try and persuade you is that it's not a transition or a change. It's actually a very sharp break with the past. And I want to take you through some of these crises to show why it's a sharp break with the past, but also why we might be able to find a way through it. So obviously, I come from the world of biomedicine, so there is going to be a little bit of a medical focus to this, but not completely, because I think many of the things that face us in biomedicine have very similar effects across many of the scholarly disciplines. So let's start, and let's start with a terrible, terrible journal. And it's a terrible, terrible journal because Nigel Hawke said it was in The Independent back in August this year. He got really upset with a paper we published, and so he used that to say that The Lancet, and in fact all peer-reviewed journals, so that's you and I really are not worth the paper, electronic or otherwise, that we are written on. And he got incredibly worked up about this, that you and I are guilty of a betrayal of all the principles of academic life. And he concludes his article by exclaiming, what a disgrace you are to civilization. So this is our starting point. Now, Nigel's a great guy. Nigel's written for The Times for years. And interestingly, the thing he doesn't say in this article is he writes a column for the BMJ regularly. So he's okay about taking a little bit of cash from a peer-reviewed journal, a very good peer-reviewed journal, but then slagging us all off in The Independent. But, you know, hypocrisy, we all do that. So that's perfectly fine. But this is simply an example, and not an uncommon example, of a certain scepticism that is there about the place of journals. Now, The Lancet isn't the only guilty party, thank goodness. And I saw Della come in earlier. Hello, Della, how are you? And I put this one in because it's just for you. University of California, the outrageous 400% increase that they were alleging. I know, what a load of nonsense, isn't it? Terrible, terrible. There was the letter that dropped through the letterbox back in June of this year. The outrageous behaviour of Nature Publishing Group, and this proposed boycott. And of course, they've now put out this very lovey-dovey press release. They're all friends again now, and they're all working together, and it's all wonderful, and they're going to send Christmas cards and all the rest of it. But, you know, clearly, I mean, 10 years ago, it was Elsevier who were the bad boys. Now, somebody else's, which is very nice. Clearly, you know, our relationships are also somewhat fraught. It's not only journals that are experiencing this difficulty, this transition, as you might like to call it. Science is going through the same thing. ClimateGate, what happened with the leaked emails at the University of East Anglia, without question, created a global movement which has undermined the science base for political action on global warming. And the sequence of reviews that have taken place about the behaviour of the University of East Anglia scientists have pointed to the central role of how scientific information is written up and disseminated, and the way journals practice peer review and the certification of science as it goes out into the public domain. Climate Chief, I won't say sorry for Glacier Era, Guardian investigation reveals how scientists kept critics out of journals. So our journals are being manipulated, the allegation is, and we therefore are stewards of this manipulation. Our journals are being manipulated to bias political opinion in one way or the other. The Muir Russell Review is a Scottish peer who was appointed by the University of East Anglia to review all of the evidence about who was right and who was wrong in this particular case, published his report in March this year. And what he showed in his report was what you and I do. And we operate a system of communication in science that is closed, tribal, partisan, secretive, conflicted, selective, intolerant, censorious, sloppy, collusive, authoritarian, and corrupt. That's the lesson of ClimateGate. And the result of that is that the public's confidence in science, and of course this is just one particular part of science, but the public's confidence was severely shaken, and illustrates how fragile and unstable that confidence is. Most people in the room, I don't know, has anybody read the Muir Russell report? Yeah, this, to me, is one of the most important reports that's been published in science in the last 20 years. It's on, if you just type in Muir Russell report into Google, you will find it. It is an incredibly important report because it opens up the way science is done. Admittedly, in a very extreme example, but I wrote an appendix on peer review to that report, and certainly sitting there as an editor, what took place in the way arguments were rehearsed over climate change is not that dissimilar at all from many of the arguments that we end up being stewards of at a journal, internally, which readers and the public never see. And all of those words can apply, certainly, to many medical journals that I know of. So we have an issue here that we have to somehow deal with. And then you open up the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, August the 24th, and we see that one of the central axial, in a way, systems on which our journals are based, the phrase that somehow gives everything we do credibility, the peer review system, may not be all it's cracked up to be. And indeed, this particular article led to a debate on the Today programme between Tracy Brown and Robin Lovell-Badge, being challenged about whether the peer review system was sustainable or not. And you're going to see that debate played out tomorrow to some extent with Richard Smith and Tracy as well. So, what can we conclude from the landscape, the current landscape around publishing? I think we can conclude that we are really successful when we anticipate the needs of the scholarly community. Do we do that well? To me, too often, we seem to oppose ourselves to that community. And I think it's time to reassess our relationship with that community and change some of the directions that we are going in. And let me try and explain why. First crisis. Too much of what you and I do is bad for your health. So let's start with a biomedical example. This is from a paper published in The Lancet by Ian Chalmers and Paul Glasziou. Ian Chalmers is the guy in Oxford who was the creator of one of the most important resources in medicine, the Cochrane Collaboration. For those of you who don't know what the Cochrane Collaboration is, it is an attempt to systematically bring together all of the evidence around a particular clinical question so that the practicing doctor can have a distillation of knowledge to know exactly what he or she should do when deciding on a treatment. So what Ian did was he looked at the state of research in medicine and he asked, are we asking questions relevant to clinicians and patients? Conclusion, when you look at the literature, we often address many low priority questions. We often don't assess important outcomes that would matter to patients. And we often don't involve the very people who matter most of all, patients and the doctors who are treating those patients. Are we using the right method so we get good, reliable answers? Actually, over half of studies are done without any concept of what the past evidence is. So do we really need to do this study or not? And over half of studies that are published don't take any notice of the steps to reduce bias, the kind of biases that would invalidate the results of the study. Can you get access to this information once it's done? This information that's not very relevant and isn't very good. Well, perhaps thankfully, over half of those studies are never actually published in full, although they do actually end up influencing opinion because they get presented at conferences. And what you do see is that there are underreporting of studies with often negative or disappointing results. So you get this bias towards the positive. And the last question he asked was, do you get an unbiased or usable report? And actually what you find out is when you look at the literature, about a third of clinical trial interventions are very poorly described. So you don't actually know what to do when a patient walks past you anyway. Half of the studies don't report outcomes, which they should be reporting. So you get a biased presentation of what the outcomes of those studies are. And again, as at the beginning, results are not interpreted in the context, the full context of the evidence. So what's the result of all this? The result is that Vince Cable today was right. That a lot of the research we do is wasted. And I have Vince Cable's speech here in front of me. And you know, when he says that the research assessment exercise defines only 54% of submitted work as world class, and that's what should be funded, and the rest of it should be ditched. That's what he says, page 6 of his 12-page speech today. You know, reflexly, I want to disagree with him, but actually, he may have a point. Maybe this is our dirty little secret. Ian Chalmers, there he is, standing up with a microphone. The dividends from tens of billions of dollars investment in research are lost every year because of correctable problems. So how can we avoid this waste? We have some solutions. We increase the involvement of patients and doctors. We get better training in research methods. Funding bodies should pay more attention to making sure we really do know all of the evidence, systematic reviews. Editors, we should spend a little more time trying to help readers understand what studies mean. We should make sure that the protocols of research are published. We should make sure that peer review is supplemented by additional reviews from, in this case, patients and other researchers. And two very important points, and I'm going to come back to access. Open access of full results, he says, is critical to weed out waste. What's more, we should be supporting the creation of repositories, again, with free access to research results. So we are seeing, again, here, the linkage between what is a quantifiable problem in science, the substantial wastage that comes from funded research, and the need to make that research transparent so you can identify what's good and what's bad. What's the second crisis? Well, the second crisis does come back to this question about peer review. Because peer review in its current incarnation is unsustainable. Tracy Brown's really excellent organization, Sense About Science, did a survey that was published this time last year on peer review. 20% of the respondents to that survey reported that they felt that peer review was unsustainable. A third of respondents reported that they didn't think the peer review system was operating to the best of its potential. And around 40% of respondents felt that the peer review system was really failing in a very, very serious way. Now, what we have, these are respondents not over 50%, it's not 60% or 70%, but what you have here is a substantial minority of the science community that is telling us that something is wrong with peer review. This matters! An editorial was published in PLOS Medicine just a few months ago, arguing that the global response to the H1N1 pandemic, thank God this virus wasn't pathogenic in the way that people thought, because if it was, you and I would have conspired in swathes, millions, tens of millions of people dying. Why? Because the information that was critical to decision makers to get out into the public domain was being delayed because of a tension that takes place in journals between the proper evaluation of research but the need to get it out into the public domain. They wrote, there is an inherent limitation in the journal publication system. The processes that ensure careful evaluation come at the expense of immediate dissemination. We ought to ask ourselves some very tough questions about how good peer review really is. Do reviewers make mistakes? God, all the time. Are reviewers objective? Hell, no, they're not. Of course they're not. Are reviewers willing to accept new ideas? Well, yes, but only if you then accept their paper when they submit it to you, often at the same time as they send in their review. Are authors able to get away with dishonest or dubious research? Yes, of course. And unfortunately, even the best journals in the world leave a track of retractions and expressions of concern which signal this dishonest or dubious research. Are peer reviewers accountable for what they do? Never. They never get into trouble if they recommend a paper should be accepted and then it turns out to be totally flawed. They're totally unaccountable. Does peer review improve the quality of published research? Of course it does. We see it every single day. The problem is there's not a shred of decent evidence to prove that. Tom Jefferson did a review that was published in a pretty good journal, JAMA, some years ago now, which has now been updated as a Cochrane review. So the very best systematic review. And what this systematic review shows is that when you actually look at the evidence around editorial peer review, we all use it, but it's largely untested and its effects are uncertain. Now, if peer review was a drug that had to get passed by the Food and Drug Administration, how would we like to defend ourselves to the public about the way we have invested to ensure that peer review is proven to be safe and effective? Because we haven't. So every time The Lancet or the New England Journal of Medicine or the BMJ writes a negative editorial about a drug company and criticizes a drug company for its practices around its particular drug, we ought to just pause for a second and ask ourselves, have we invested in proving or not the effectiveness of the tool on which so much of our work depends? Because we haven't. The third crisis is the crisis that we prefer many times not to talk about, because access is an issue that is not going to go away. I hear a lot that, well, open access journals is just 1% of the journal population. That's not changing very much. So it's got a niche, but it's a small niche, and we can pretty much relax. That is utter nonsense. Science published an excellent 3-page review very recently, at the end of last month, looking at the first decade of open access. And in their assessment, between 7 and 11% of peer-reviewed journals are now open access. A fifth of articles are freely available. We're in a situation where the NIH policy on access may well be extended to 6 months, for example. And PLOS One has become one of the most successful journals on the planet, certainly the world's largest journal. Open access journals, it concluded, are on the rise. Let's just see how much they're on the rise. That was the figure that was published in Science. Excuse me, on the top, you can see from July 2002 to August 2010. And what you're looking at here is the growth of peer-reviewed open access journals. Thank you, Ian, that's great. That's all right. So you can see that going up to August 2010, you have got a very, very steady rise, both in terms of the number of open access journals and also the number of the percentage of open access journals as a percent of all journals. This is not a small niche that is stable. This is a growing population. And then when you look at the different disciplines, with medicine at the top and physics at the bottom, you can see a different pattern of accessibility. So with medicine, a fairly large proportion of this, on average 20% of accessible articles, is coming from the journal site, fewer from repositories. In physics, the other way round. But you can see that this is a very, very significant, substantial part of the publication process. When you set that in a larger context, for example, the context of, does it actually make any difference to anybody? Or is this all a rather intellectual debate? When you survey all of the scientific evidence around human development, that's to say, development of countries, low middle-income countries, countries that have growing economies, building healthcare systems, building education systems, the conclusion, this is a report that was published earlier this year, is that the major limitation to human development is a lack of access to knowledge. Knowledge defined very broadly. So I'm not just talking about journal articles here. Health technologies, of which knowledge is a part, technologies also includes the hardware, of course, to that. So our journals are a small part of this total knowledge system, but they're an important part. And so the case for wider access becomes a moral case, as well as an issue about whether people should have the right to access, because whether it's taxpayer-funded or not. There is a fourth crisis, and this relates to the media. And I know that there was a session on the media this afternoon. I went to part of the China session, so I didn't attend this one. So I don't know what was said, but we've got ourselves into a really bad place with the media. It's a silly, stupid place to be. Because although, yeah, we do sometimes have reason to hate them, the Daily Mail comes to mind, we take the news media too much for granted. The news media are actually our friend, not our enemy. I am second to none in admiring the work of Ben Goldacre. His Bad Science column in The Guardian on Saturday, his book, his website, have done an enormously valuable service in sharpening up the quality of science reporting in the United Kingdom. Every country needs a Ben Goldacre. But his argument is taken to such an extreme, which is that science and health journalists are simply not qualified to do their job, The result being that what we have in science and health journalism is, as he calls it, a manifesto for failure. Lives are at stake from flat misinformation about health. And what's the journalist's response to that? The journalist's response to that can appear to be very weak. Jeremy Lawrence, who is one of the most experienced health journalists in the UK, now writing for The Independent, asked, "Is Ben Goldacre losing it? Standards are pretty high," he said. "Reporters are simply messengers. We're under pressure. You should feel sorry for us." Of course, if you're Ben and you're looking at that, you think that's a pretty pathetic kind of response. Just because you're writing to Deadline, we should forgive you your mistakes. But the danger of setting up this opposition between science and the media is that we don't see the really good things that the media can do for science. I'll just give you one example. Earlier this year, we published a paper from a group in Seattle, from the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation in the University of Washington, which recalculated, on the basis of better information, the number of deaths of women in pregnancy in the world. This figure for 20 years had been thought to be 500,000 and hadn't changed at all for 20 years. And what Chris Murray and his team did, he showed that actually that's not true. That in fact, there had been a continuous decline in maternal deaths to just over 300,000 over that 20-year period. Why is that important? Because this year, in 2 weeks' time, at the UN General Assembly in New York, there will be a meeting to decide how many more billions of dollars will be spent on maternal health. And if you can show that the money that's been spent for 20 years has saved women's lives, you will persuade politicians to spend more money. If you had gone to that meeting and said, all the billions you've spent haven't made the slightest difference, not the slightest difference, we would not have got more money. This was a front page article above the fold in the New York Times. And it was so well reported and so well timed because that report by a journalist, not by The Lancet, not by Chris Murray, by a journalist in a newspaper, was in front of the UN Secretary General, the prime ministers of three countries who were at a meeting on Long Island to talk about the strategy for maternal health. And the press conference they gave the same week that this newspaper report came out, their responses were to this newspaper report saying that the world needed to do more for maternal health. That would not have happened in the way that it happened if it hadn't been for this newspaper. So we have to get out of this mindset of fear around the media and change that relationship to a more positive one. Because there's a bigger issue here. And that issue is that many of the big topics that should be covered by the media are not being covered. This is a look at geotagged Wikipedia articles per country in all languages. And what you see is these great holes in the world where we are not reporting on critical. This is across a whole range of different issues, not just scholarly sciences or humanities. But this illustrates that in Africa, in South Asia, in parts of Latin America, we are simply not covering issues that matter to those countries. So in the global news melee that we have a very biased view of what matters on the planet. So journalism has an important responsibility in getting a more equitable view of that. We should be working harder with journalists who are our friends, not our enemies. The fifth crisis revolves around a question that I hear talked about a lot. What's our value proposition? That's a question that we get asked in Elsevier a lot. What are we doing here? Why does The Lancet have 68 people working for it? Surely you could do with just 12. I mean, why all this headcount? We've got to save some money. Come on, Richard. You know, really, do you really need to have all these editors sitting around all day thinking? What does scholarly publishing contribute to the world? You know, as we've outsourced, offshored large parts of what we do in publishing, This is a question that societies frequently ask us. And it's a difficult question that publishers have to answer in society presentations. And it's a question we sometimes can't answer, so societies carry on self-publishing. What is it that we are contributing to this great process? I think we, again, have to rethink what it is we are offering. My view is that what we are offering is something quite transformational to society. I think that what journals do at their best is provide a platform for social reform, social progress, that no other industry provides on the planet. If you go back and you read the introduction by D'Alembert to Diderot's Encyclopedia, why create an encyclopedia of knowledge? Why put it all together and bind it between two covers? It wasn't just because they were passionate about knowledge. It wasn't just because they wanted to publish something. It wasn't because they wanted to make money. If you read D'Alembert's introduction, he says, we are bringing knowledge together in this encyclopedia for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is social reform. That was the phrase he used. To make a better society at a moment of enlightenment. Now, in our postmodernist world, to talk like that sounds incredibly pretentious. But actually, that is what it is we are doing. Science, and I'm speaking for the little part of scholarly publishing that I'm in, but I believe this applies across the range of academic disciplines. Science is a catalyst for that kind of social change. And the partnerships that we create through the work that we do deliver massive global impact. Your journals, my journal, can trigger that kind of social action in ways that most spheres of our life simply can't do. Your journals, and sometimes my journal, we can be leaders not just of scientific change, but also political change in ways that are absolutely central to the lives of people in our society. So let me just give you one small example. And it's the idea of a journal as an NGO for knowledge. And it's a project that we've been working on since 2003. And it started in the top left-hand corner with a series of series, essentially. And what we've done is to try and work with the best scientists in the world in neglected areas of human concern, such as maternal newborn child health, and then running down this list on the left, to ask questions, what is the sum state of knowledge about this particular field? But not just the scientific knowledge, but to then say, and this is why it's an NGO, because there's a social and a political dimension to this, not in a party political way, but in terms of a getting things done kind of way, that if you bring together the sum total of the best scientific knowledge on a particular issue, and then you bolt onto it recommendations about what our political leaders should do about that, then what you have is science as a platform, a foundation for advocacy and change. And using science in that way, in a very directed way, journals are not simply... There was a biography written once of a journal, and it was called A Mirror of Medicine. And in a way, that's how we've run our journals, that they are mirrors of the particular sphere of science that we represent. And I think that is a really outdated view of the way we should be running our journals. And I'm going to try and prove that to you in a moment with another example. Our journals should be much more than that. Our journals should go back 300 years to D'Alembert's idea of why it is we create knowledge in the first place. That it has, you know, it's a vector. It has a force, but it has a direction. And what is that direction? We don't usually have those sorts of discussions at meetings in publishing. And yet, that, I think, is going back to the core idea of why we started publishing in the first place. We try to extend this to look at country analyses. So taking some politically interesting countries and ask questions about what's the current state of your health system reform, can we bring together your local experts and your international experts to solve some of your problems in the healthcare system? We've published 4 so far, just on Mexico, China, Palestine, and South Africa, but we have these other countries in the pipeline over the next 18 months. And the idea is we work with ministries of health, we work with the scientific community, public health communities, we work with the media in those countries to try and bring together the best knowledge to inform political decision making. We also try and this is another big change in science, at least while I've been at The Lancet. I've been there too long now, 15 years. And the thing that's changed for us is multidisciplinarity. 15 years ago, we didn't get papers that involved different disciplines, even within medicine. What we now see is this massive change of multidisciplinarity. So recognizing that the world's biggest problems that it faces, like climate change, are going to demand people from different disciplines working together. Complex problems are going to require complex solutions. What is the best institution to deal with that? The best institution we have in society that can bring together people from different disciplines is the university. It's the only institution we have that has those disciplines within its single umbrella. So the idea is that you bring together people within a university to focus on one particular issue. And this one was with University College London on climate change. And it's weird because when you get people in the room from different disciplines they've never met before, it's really uncomfortable. It's like a first date. You have a philosopher with a political scientist, with somebody from biomedicine, with an economist, with a geographer, with an environmental scientist. They're in the same university, but they don't know each other. But over the course of 6 months or so, they suddenly start to work together in different ways. And what we've tried to do is to commission and publish these kinds of reports that can show at their best what science can do for society. The sixth crisis is around the university. A very popular word where I come from is customer. And that is entirely appropriate, except when we think of the university as a customer rather than as a partner in knowledge, I think we make a big mistake. I don't think we've really understood the importance of the university as a core institution for what we do. Now, our usual way into a university is through the library. And Elsevier sponsored some work that was published recently that looked at, if you invest in a library, what is the return on that investment? And across 9 universities, the return on that investment did vary. It varied from about 15 to 1 in the best instance to less than 1 in the worst instance. But what it shows is, and this is what Carol Tenapier concluded, that for every monetary unit invested in libraries, the institutions received a return in grant income, and this was the outcome measure, ranging from 15 to less than 1. The point being that when you get it right, that investment in the library can bring an enormous return to a university. And certainly we need to be strong advocates for libraries, and we have been. And we've done a pretty good job, I would say, at working positively with libraries in this way. But libraries aren't the end of what a university is. And actually, it may well be that they become a smaller part of what a university is. Here's Peter Morgan from Cambridge writing in an email to me in June this year. Like all other UK university libraries, we're facing very severe cuts in our budget over the next few years, and a reduction in our expenditure on journals appears inevitable, even if all journals were to be pegged at current subscription prices. So let's step back and ask ourselves, why do we have universities in the first place? The old view, and this was from the 1970s, was that universities should be disinterested places of study. Should have nothing to do with the wider world, should be totally closed off from the problems of the wider world. And Kev Minogue put it brilliantly. Universities are not devoted to the improvement of the world. Their attention should be remote from the urgencies moving men, this was the 70s, in day-to-day endeavour. That is not the way any university thinks in 2010. Two examples, University College and University of Oslo, two places I've been to recently. University College London now badges itself as a global university, and rather than that being a piece of marketing rhetoric, is trying to make that something meaningful in the way it does its job. It has set up four grand challenges across the university to try and give very strategic direction to what the university will be concerned with. So departments can carry on publishing, doing their thing in the way that they're expected to do, getting their grant income. But in addition to that, they want to create a moral compass for the university across these four areas of global health, sustainable cities, intercultural studies, and human well-being. Those are the four areas that they think match global urgencies with some of the comparative advantages that University College has. Flip over to the University of Oslo, and they have a relatively new rector there, Hans Petter Ottersen. He's a great neuroscientist. In their latest strategy that was published just over the summer, the way they interpret their role in society is not as the leading university in Norway, but as an international university with international concerns. Trying to build up research-based education that has that international dimension, directing its attention not to just investigator-led research, but to some of the pressing social challenges that surround that university. And not just being concerned with publishing research papers, but identifying actions that others can do and be held accountable for. When you look at the Shanghai University ratings published last month, you can see where we sit. The United States dominates, if you look on the left-hand side, dominates, of course, massively. Only Cambridge and Oxford are in that top 10. If you look in the non-US universities, though, you can see that the United Kingdom, with Cambridge, Oxford, UCL, and Imperial, occupy four slots in the top 50. So we have a very, very strong footprint. In fact, if you look in the top 100, we have 11 universities in the Shanghai Index. In addition to those four, we have Manchester, Edinburgh, King's, Bristol, Nottingham, Sheffield, and Birmingham. Even though we are this tiny, pathetic little island, we are the second most powerful, and by powerful I mean soft powerful, intellectually powerful country in the world by virtue of what? By virtue of our universities. And then I opened the newspaper today, and there's page two of The Guardian. Topping the league, this is a different university ranking, the QS rankings, which take account more of the opinions of other scientists, Cambridge has displaced Harvard. So now we have, in the top 10, those four that were in the top 50. This is an incredible achievement. But on the same day that these rankings were published, that should give us immense pride and immense motivation to do something positive for our universities, the OECD published a report with a warning. For many years, the United Kingdom was very much at the forefront. This was looking at universities and investment in universities. But now you do not see that competitive advantage. So, as I looked at their figures this morning, this is what you see. If you look down at the bottom on the left, the OECD average of percentage of GDP spent on universities is 1%. OECD includes countries like Mexico, the United States, New Zealand, Australia. So let's just take the European Union. It's 1.1% of GDP. And indeed, when you look at Canada, it's 1.5%. Sweden, Norway, over 1%. Even France, 1.2%. The US, 1%. Where's the UK? 0.7%. Vince Cable, in his speech today, made it very clear that we are going to have to, he says, ration research. Those are his words. Screen out mediocrity. So I have attention here, because I recognize that some of what he says in the context of Ian Chalmers is correct. But I also recognize that our universities are one of the most precious possessions of our society. And it's the same in every country. Our universities are that important. And they're not just important because it's soft power. They're important because they contribute economically too. This is what the OECD concluded in its report today. A man with a tertiary level, and they do say a man, A man with a tertiary level of education will generate $119,000 more in income taxes and social contributions over his working life than someone with just an upper secondary level of education. So you multiply that up to the tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people who have a university education, and you're talking about a significant economic impact. Put that in the context of what Vince Cable has said and the narrowing of vision that may result from a big contraction, 20 to 25%, we were told at the Academy of Medical Sciences when Adrian Smith from Department of Business Innovation and Skills came to talk to us. If we see that kind of cut, then we really do risk these kinds of headlines that appeared in the Times today coming true. And as John Bell, who's the president of the Academy of Medical Sciences, said in his typically blunt language, if you're going to leave it, that is, if you're going to leave science to the guy shaking his tin outside of Sainsbury's, that isn't going to work. So we have a really, really big decision to make. So when we are advocates for libraries, what are we saying about universities as publishers? When I look at the people who are advocating on behalf of universities, and maybe you're going to be able to tell me there are wonderful examples of your publishing operations who are doing this, but I do not see the kind of public advocacy from publishers about universities. We should be in the front line trumpeting the value that universities offer to our society, both in terms of the knowledge creation, the innovation, and the economic capital that they develop. But our vision of what a university is so constrained to one part of it that we don't have this big view about what a university is doing. So go back to my slide when I said we're at our best when we align ourselves, anticipate the needs of society and the needs of the institutions around us. We are not doing that with universities. We're not looking at what the data tell us and then being fantastic advocates for these core social institutions. It's worse than that because although that's true parochially, it's also true even more so globally because we've often been slow, some negligently slow, to respond to globalization. Now, this is a somewhat old slide now because it only goes up to 2003, but I'll update it in the next slide. But what you see here is the United States going down as a proportion of published articles. Now that's going down not just because the rest of the world is publishing more. The output of the United States, and this is from a National Science Foundation report from a couple of years ago, the output from the United States is actually getting less in absolute terms. And what you're seeing is the EU sort of, in typical EU fashion, sort of not deciding what it's doing. And then what you see slowly, East Asia going up. So how are we responding to that? And it's great you had the session on China. But it's more than that. It's a change in the way research scholarly disciplines are working. So here, again, forgive me, this is just medicine, looking at the kinds of collaborations between countries that are done. So Europe, This is according to WHO regions, Europe, the Americas, North and South America, Western Pacific, Southeast Asia, Mediterranean, and Africa. And here, so just take one. Europe, about 5% of papers are concerned with low middle income countries, and about 20% of those papers have authors from two or more countries. So even in a very, very highly developed zone, you're getting a substantial amount of collaboration across countries. And as you go down these areas, you're seeing, of course, an increase in focus and attention to middle-income country issues, but you're seeing a massive increase in the kinds of collaborations you see between scientists. So the idea that the best science in the world is done in a particularly fantastic centre, like UCL, Cambridge, Imperial, or Oxford, isn't true. Because what they're doing is actually having fantastic networks of scientists. And what they show in this NSF report is that the highest impact scientific research is actually done by collaborations between universities across different countries. And indeed, if you look at the amount of money that's now being spent on global science, and this is looking again just at health, and the massive increase from 1990 to 2007 in global health, and the amount of money, therefore, that's available to do research as a proportion of that, we are seeing a transformation in the way we are seeing the world today. This rapid globalization, which is changing quantitatively and qualitatively the nature of the research process. So, let me answer my boss's question. Richard, what is your value proposition? Your cough's worse than mine. Clinical trials, I'm focusing on here. Quality. We're very focused sometimes on market share. We spend less attention to the quality of what it is we publish. And we see this, sadly, across many sectors. Often have metrics for market share and talk less about quality, or talk about quality in impact factor terms, which is a very one-dimensional way to talk about quality. What we try and do at The Lancet is look at what are the measures of quality in terms of the research that we might publish. And it's not impact factor. It's a particular type of article. And for us, it's randomized trials. So in your sector of scholarly publishing, what would be the definition of a high-quality article? Can you actually define that? And we try and do that, and then we do compare ourselves with our major competitors. We have two competitors that we are particularly concerned about, New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA. And we track our performance against those two journals in the types of scientific papers that matter to us. We also try and use these collaborations with scientists for advocacy, for policy development. And this is the first one that started it in 2003. And it was a group of scientists who called on various organizations in the world to act on behalf of children by putting child survival top of the list of their priorities. And this was pure advocacy, but based upon science. We try and work with partners, not just being a mirror to what's going on out there, but actually partnering with organizations such as WHO, and what would be your equivalent, to, again, leverage the impact of the science that we publish. We try and work with countries. In the case of China, we went to the Chinese Ministry of Health, we went to the Minister of Health, and we said, can we work with you to bring in international scientists in a collaboration to examine the state of your health system and where it's going? And the guy who's the Minister of Health in China is a very unusual man, Chen Zhu, who happens to publish papers in journals like Science. And he was dead keen to work with a journal in the West to try and bring in that kind of collaboration. We try and do that not just in middle-income countries. That isn't 3D, that really is blurred, I apologize for that. We try and work with high-income countries too. I was in Japan last week, again, working with the media, working with the scientific community, working with government to look at what we could do as a journal to act as a kind of a broker, a convener, a catalyst to bring scientists together to try and answer some of the predicaments facing their health system. So, extinction or evolution? Or are we just simply trying to survive? I think if we get the diagnosis of what the problem is, then actually we can do more than survive. We can thrive. But right now, we have not got the right diagnosis. We spend an enormous amount of time talking about things as editors like conflicts of interest and commercial influence. And I do that myself. And actually, those aren't the big issues that are shaping our future. The big issues that are shaping our future are some of those that I've talked about in my world. So if we don't make that right diagnosis, I really do think we are going to be like that dodo in that opening slide. We need to step back and take a look at the really big picture. And when we step back and look at the big picture, we get a very different view. Carlos Fuentes, the great Mexican novelist, said this in a book recently, summarizing his life. "I'm concerned about a world without witnesses," which I thought was a beautiful phrase, because what are we as publishers, as editors? We are witnesses to what is taking place on our planet. We are observers of the changes and the predicaments that we face. And our journals are emblems of the very best of humanity to respond to those predicaments with the very best information that can shape decision making. So I think that if we get the diagnosis right, if we step back and look at that much bigger canvas, if we act as witnesses to the way the world is changing, then we are not just talking about survival. We are talking about the kind of transformation in society that took place during the Enlightenment. We can be the catalysts for that change, and that makes me enormously excited and proud to be part of modern 21st century publishing. Thank you very much indeed.
Richard, thank you very much for such a fantastic opening to the conference. Sorry, I'm a bit boomy. We do have time for some questions, if there are any from the audience. If you could, I would ask if you could both mention your name and your affiliation, and also please do wait until you have the microphone in your hand, if you would. Questions? Kent Anderson must have a question. I can't see him. Where are you, Kent?
You found that pub across the road.
No questions?
The bar's open, you see.
Maybe that's it. We have one. Sorry, Mark Carden, Publishing Technology. Not a good question, but a first question to get us going. When you talk about universities, it seems to me that you're to some extent eliding together the research agenda of universities and the undergraduate importance of universities. So you talk about OECD figures about what a graduate would contribute or a percentage of GDP spent on universities, and that seems to me to be a mixture of the undergraduate agenda and the research agenda. Do you have some thoughts on those two components of university activity?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. When you look at the tables on the OECD website, they don't disaggregate from education and research. But if you think about our world, we are supplying journals and information in books or whatever form that meets both of those needs, of course. So I think for us as publishers, we are covering all those different spheres of what a university does. And whether it's on the educational side or the research side, they remain those core social institutions. Although it's true the data aren't disaggregated, I'm not sure that it matters from our point of view as advocates for universities. And God, they need that advocacy right now.
Any other questions? There's one here. Thank you, Mark. You did indeed start things off, so thank you.
Talking about Mary Henning, Therapeutic Guidelines Australia, talking about the research agenda again a bit, given this, much of the funding for research in the pharmaceuticals area is funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Would you care to comment on the relationship or the effect that is having on the research agenda and evidence-based medicine?
Without question, because you don't have patients involved in, so we're talking about health now, of course, Because you don't have patients helping to set the agenda, the people who set the agenda tend to be the scientists and the people who fund the science. So this is where Ian Chalmers' argument becomes so important, that we have to find ways to bring patients in to help shape that agenda. So every funding organisation should be finding a way to bring patient representatives into their decision-making process. Now, it's so easy to say and so impossible to do at a practical level, because who is a patient representative? I mean, it's really, really hard to find a representative of, you know, these constituencies of patients aren't organised in that way. So it is difficult, but it's certainly coming together. In the UK, we now have an organisation that does represent patient groups. We have charities that are drawn together, the Association of Medical Research Charities, which can provide that voice as well. So it's slowly happening, these counterforces to very big financial interests that can sometimes misshape the research agenda, which you're absolutely right about.
There's one here, Noel will take you first.
I'm Noel Verhagen, I'm the librarian of the University of Amsterdam, so I'm going to be a bit of a rare duck in this this community. Thank you very much for your talk, Richard. I admired the depth and the bandwidth, so to say, of the self-criticism that you are prepared to offer us to us, and that I usually lack in my own community when we are talking about ourselves as universities and university libraries. But since you dealt with some aspects of the relationship between scholarly publishing and the universities, I would say that you are a bit blaming yourself too much for the deficiencies of the peer review system, of course, because at the end of the day, it's not the scholarly publisher who is responsible for the peer review, but it's the academic community itself. So it's just quite a complicated relationship. And I must say that from my community, I almost never hear such a severe criticism on the peer review system. As we are talking as librarians with our professors about publishing and about reshaping the publishing mechanisms and open access, the only thing I ever hear is, at least as we can maintain peer review, because that is, at the end of the day, still the system and the mechanism that researchers are familiar with and that they have trusted in. Another issue, as I may continue, is about the relationship between universities and scholarly publishing. And I must say, maybe it's not rightful, but justified, but it is a fact that scholarly publishers by universities and by university librarians and by university managers are often seen and spoken about as people who are making money of what we are doing in research, and I think that is an unhealthy attitude and also an unhealthy relationship between scholarly publishers and scholarly publishing as a, let's say, as an activity and the universities. And I think one of the main issues in the survival of scholarly publishing is indeed to improve that relationship and to find again a sort of mutual respect that is not based on money making but on partnering and cooperating in the sake of science.
Well,
comment to that?
Yeah, well, on your first point about peer review, I mean, as an editor, I'm devil's advocate in what I'm saying, because as an editor, I daily see the value of peer review. So, of course, I agree with you, and I'm a big defender of it. My problem is that when we look at the vast amounts of money and systems we create for peer review, we have not done a good job at identifying what peer review is good at and what it's not good at, and then having figured out what it's not good at, plugging those gaps. And we really just haven't done it. It's just not there. And my worry is that when we go out to the public, we make claims about peer review that simply aren't true. And so, as a result, when a problem happens like ClimateGate, we look stupid. So there is an organisation, Sense About Science, which does a fantastic job, but one of the things it says about peer review, it's the arbiter of scientific quality. Now, I wish it was, but peer review on its own, that's pre-publication peer review, is not the arbiter of scientific quality. Scientific quality is a concept that evolves over a considerable period of time after publication. What looks great at publication can turn out to be rubbish and vice versa. So we have to be very careful about the language we use. On your point about partnership, well, I think that was the point I was trying to make, that we are trying to strengthen our partnerships with other organisations in the intellectual world that we exist in. And I feel sometimes that we don't work hard enough about building those partnerships. I really don't. I feel sometimes we're a little standoffish. We're a little bit frightened of building those partnerships. And actually, we need to, you know, we should be sitting side by side, vice-chancellors, provosts, or whatever we call them, whichever country. We have shared concerns. We should have shared strategies.
Down here.
Oh no, I'm definitely keeping you from the bar.
Magnus from the International Relations Article Society. I would like to get your opinion on peer review and how peer review is used, and impact factors, and how impact factors are used by funding agencies to almost control what type of research and where scientists publish. And this is especially true in the third world countries, that if you do not publish in this particular type of journal, then we're not going to fund you.
I know. You know, it's very hard for me to speak about other journals. Let me just talk about The Lancet. 10 or 11 years ago, so this is not the current situation, so we're in a wonderful world now, but 10 or 11 years ago, we were not in a wonderful world, where I am. And I was living in a system whereby people looked at what was published in The Lancet, this is in, you know, our publishers, and said to me, why are you publishing articles about Africa? A, they get you no impact factor, B, they don't make you any money. And therefore, The Lancet is a drag on the profitability and success of this publishing operation. You should stop publishing papers on Africa, and you should stop publishing papers on global health, and start publishing more papers on drugs and clinical trials. And this was, at the time, it was the closest I ever came to resigning, because the pressure was so, so great. And it was driven by the kind of metrics that you're talking about. Because, like it or not, we do all in that moment in whenever they come out in June, and Isabel, you know, this is what it was like, wasn't it? It was, you know, and Isabel and I have had a love relationship for many years, but there was a moment, Isabel, wasn't there, where, you know, maybe we, you know, it was a bit warm in the room. No. But, you know, because the pressure, and it was probably around that time, the pressure can be so great not to do things that lead you to have bad metrics. So we have made a conscious decision, actually. So my main competitors in the New England Journal, their impact factor is around 50. We have an impact factor of 30, around that. And so if we dropped all malaria, HIV in Africa, all that stuff, all child survival in Guinea-Bissau, we didn't do any of that, we think our impact factor could jump, not maybe to 50, but pretty close. So what do? We've made a decision that actually we're very happy with 30. And it will bobble around that, it will go down 1 year and go up a bit another year. And we're not going to go for 50, because if we do that, we won't be the journal we want to be. That said, we know that we will lose papers to the New England Journal, because authors will see that the New England Journal is 50. And that is a decision you have to take. And it's a really, you know, we are having to sacrifice doing as well as a journal that I have great admiration for and would like to come closer to. We have to sacrifice that to be a different kind of journal. And it's a horrible, horrible trade-off, and I hate it. But I don't have any choice. Which do you do? You either cut off Africa and Asia and go for it with our main competitor, or you accept for being second place. And we have had to accept that that's where we're going to be.
So in other words, the impact factor is in controlling, is the controlling factor in this?
Because for authors, and this is not my publishing name, for authors, I go out and talk to authors and you ask them what determines where you send your paper. And in my world of biomedicine, it is impact factor number one. Two, three, four, absolutely. It's the thing that drives everything. So that's why, you know, if it was a straight fight between me and my publisher, that would be easy, but it's not. It's the authors that determine it.
Okay, we're going to take one more question. I know there were a bunch of hands here, but we'll go right to the back there, if I may, for a final question.
Michael Jupp from the Research Information Network. One thing that I was surprised not to hear more about in the Nature of Challenges was Web 2. And the relationship as you see it evolving between scholarly journals on the one hand, blogs, wikis, collaborative authoring tools, recommender sites, and so on. How do you see that evolving over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was sitting down thinking what would I make as my crises, my predicaments, I deliberately excluded that one. Because I think this is one of these issues that occupies a phenomenal amount of our time. And it's very interesting, and it's tremendous fun. And we have a Facebook site, we do tweets, and we love it. We seem to have dozens of editors running around doing this all the time. And it's great, because you get this instant feedback. It's this gratification that is just fabulous. But in the great scheme of what's shaping science and society, and therefore publishing, I really don't put that in my top 7. So I do exclude it. I think these are great experiments. I think this is a lot of fun. It's great to play with. Do I think it's so substantive that this is going to change the world? I really don't see that. Because if you look at the what the internet is doing, it is the determining factor for some of these issues, not the most important issue in itself. So for example, why do we see, what is one of the driving forces for greater collaboration and greater interdisciplinarity? It is the electronic availability of information, the ability to move across different information fields very rapidly. And with ease, there's a paper published in Science a couple of years ago showing this beautifully over the course of some years. So what you're identifying is an important issue, but it's actually not the issue that's going to change the world in the way that I think the networks of science themselves are going to change it. It's an upstream effect, which to me is important, but not as important as the consequence.
Okay. There, I think we will leave it.
There, I think we will leave it. But could we just say, express our appreciation to Richard one more time for writing this. Should also did a pretty fantastic job of outlining the programme for the next few days. It's a much better job than I did, mentioning a few of the things on the agenda. So do study the programme, decide which of the parallel sessions that you're going to go to. The three parallel sessions will be in this room, which will split into two, and also in the Robinson room, which is just opposite the bar, sort of, to the right of the bar. Anyway, once again, my thanks to Richard.